worked in the information technology industry for more than 16 years. He attends and organizes conferences about the creative use of technology. He also enjoys gaming and recently attended CatanCon 2016 in Nashville with his daughter. Ben obtained an associate's degree in theology from Beacon University and has a strong interest in the areas of communication and effective mediation. Ben will speak on the topic, Loving the Other, Rising to the Challenge of Finding Common Ground. Let's welcome Ben.
All right, I've edited 60 minutes of content down to 20, so get ready. When I was little, my dad took me fishing a lot, and I bet Joe can relate to this. He had this pair of glasses called his fishing glasses, and they're not normal sunglasses. They were polarized. The lenses were polarized so that if you were looking at the water, and we always stood at the bank. We didn't have a boat or anything, but when you're looking at the water, instead of seeing the reflection, you could see through the reflection and see the fish actually swimming around. So they're the polarized glasses. And about an hour ago, I kid you not, I thought of that when I was talking, oh, I need to do some editing. So I ran in and wrote this story down because it's a really apt metaphor for what I'm talking about today, which I'm talking a lot about polarization, and I'm talking a lot about the political climate in our country. My talk today is about the increasingly apparent divide we have in our culture, what political scientists and scholars called polarization. The main sources I will be quoting from is one of my favorite authors and moral psychologist, Dr. Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And I quote from a rant that the New York Times op-ed columnist Frank Bruni wrote called How Facebook Warps Our World. It's really fun. And I finally also quote from two articles in the magazine, The American Interest, by writer David Blankenhorn. And the articles are called Why Polarization Matters and The Seven Habits of Highly Depolarizing People, which is good stuff. So can we all get along? That appeal was made famous on May 1st, 1992 by Rodney King, a black man who had been beaten nearly to death by four Los Angeles police officers a year earlier. The entire nation had seen a videotape of the beating, so when a jury failed to convict the officers, their acquittal triggered widespread outrage and 6 days of rioting in Los Angeles. 53 people were killed, and more than 7,000 buildings were torched. It says more than 7,000 buildings were torched. I should have looked that up. Much of the mayhem was carried live. News cameras tracked the action from helicopters circling overhead after a particularly horrific act of violence against a white truck driver. King was then moved to make an appeal for peace, and King's appeal has now been so overused that it's become a culture cliche, a catchphrase that we often say for laughs more than a serious plea for mutual understanding. Can't we all get along? King's statement referred to racial tensions at the time, but we can all appreciate the sentiment in the midst of this political season. So I've broken my talk into two main parts. Why and how does this growing divide in our culture exist, and what can we do about it? Don't imagine that polarization is the same as a strong disagreement. In a free society, people naturally have many different and strongly held views. That's normal and even desirable. Polarization involves something else, quite a bit stronger than differing opinions. Formal editor of the American Interest, James Q. Wilson, defined polarization this way. Polarization is an intense commitment to a candidate, a culture, or an ideology that sets people in one group definitively apart from people in another rival group. Such a condition is revealed when a candidate for public office is regarded by a competitor and his supporters not simply as wrong, but as corrupt or wicked. When one way of thinking about the world is assumed to be morally superior to any other way, then one set of political beliefs is considered to be entirely correct and a rival set wholly wrong. The word contempt comes to mind when I heard that. If you hold someone or some group in contempt, hopefully you can be persuaded to change your opinion by the end of this, or at least see them through a new pair of fishing glasses. Most of us can't browse through Facebook or flip through the television without coming across strongly worded accusations and name calling on political sides today. Even with issues in living memory like Vietnam and desegregation, polls and research show us that Americans are more divided than at any other time now, except perhaps the Civil War or the years leading up to the Civil War. Stanford professor Shanto Iyengar and his colleagues recently found that when it comes to trusting other people with our money, Americans today are less friendly to people in the other political party than they are to people of different races. The researchers conclude that Americans increasingly dislike people in groups on the other side of the political divide and face no social repercussions for the open expression of those attitudes. As a result today, the level of partisan animus in the American public exceeds racial animus. I don't think we can point at any specific thing or moment as a crossing of the Rubicon, but more subtly, here are a number of things that have worked together to contribute to a largening divide in our culture. We weren't always this way. Polls and research show that Americans were once very united when returning from World War II. Politicians of that era were used to compromising with the other side on issues. Many returning veterans joined churches and started families almost as a part of their patriotic duty after returning from the war. They married and they had their 2.5 kids and their cars and the white picket fences. Perhaps because our culture had just faced such a grave threat and the threat of a Cold War kept Americans from turning inward and against each other. Political cooperation at that time was an all-time high. But things begin to change over the next 60 years. For politicians, air transportation became more readily available, and politicians from both sides began spending less time together on weekends in Washington and started returning home and back to their districts. Our sources of news changed. In the past 60 years, the news media was shaken up, and 24-hour news was born. Monopolies formed, and now news that follows preconceived ideologies have arrived. As Americans, we can now choose to have the media that tells us what we want to hear. There is also much evidence to suggest that people are voting with their feet now, even moving to areas where other like-minded people live politically. The evidence I read about was that so many more landslide elections happen now than what used to, because such a large population of people that think the same live together. Last but probably not least, and a subject very near and dear to my heart, the internet was born. And more importantly to this issue, social media and Facebook. We can all choose our friends now and reshare the stories that we want to read and see. In short, we can create a filter bubble now more easily than ever before of people around ourselves that think like us, talk like us, share our opinions, and even live in areas we frequent. By creating such a homogenous herd, we are pressuring ourselves to conform to it and even allowing that herd to pick our thoughts at times. Here's an excerpt from How Facebook Warps Our World, which is a rant in the New York Times that I read. It said, those who've been raising alarms about Facebook are right. Almost every minute that we spend on our smartphones and tablets and laptops, thumbing through favorite websites and scrolling through personalized feeds, we're pointed toward foregone conclusions. We're pressured to conform. But unseen puppet masters on Mark Zuckerberg's payroll aren't to blame. We're the real culprits. When it comes to elevating one perspective above all others and herding people into culturally and ideologically inflexible tribes, nothing that Facebook does to us comes close to what we do to ourselves. More prevalent for many users are the posts we see from friends and from other people in groups we follow on the network. And this information is utterly contingent on choices we ourselves make. If we seek out, like, and comment on angry missives from Bernie Sanders supporters, we'll be confronted with more angry missives from Bernie Sanders supporters. If we banish such outbursts, those dispatches disappear. Crucial dynamic, algorithm, or whatever you want to call it, that's the trap and curse of our lives online. The internet isn't rigged to give us right or left, conservative or liberal, at least not until we rig it that way. It's designed to give us more of the same. Whatever the same is, one sustained note from the vast and varied music that it holds, one redundant fragrance from a garden of infinite possibility. So it goes with the fiction we read, the movies we watch, the music we listen to, and scarily, the ideas we subscribe to. They're not challenged, they're validated and reinforced. By bookmarking given blogs and personalizing social media feeds, we customize the news we consume and the political beliefs we're exposed to as never before. And this colors our days, or rather, bleeds them of color, reducing them to a single hue. We construct precisely contoured echo chambers of affirmation that turn conviction into zeal, passion into fury, and disagreements with the other side into the demonization of it. Then we marvel at the Twitter mobs that swarm in defense of Sanders or the surreal success of Donald Trump's candidacy with historical tagline may well be, all I know is what's on the internet. I really like that article. Anyway, so here we are, living in a time when it's easier to educate ourselves more than ever before. Cable television and networks and the growth of the internet promises to expand our worlds and not shrink them, but they have instead, for a lot of us, enhanced the speed with which we retreat into our herd and for those who, our herd of those that think like us. It's sort of a bunny trail, and I know I've talked about this before, but has anyone ever heard of the term microaggression and triggering? Since 2003, college campuses have been abuzz with these two new terms. Well, I guess they're not new, but used now a lot. Not from the faculty and the staff, but from the students themselves. When encountering uncomfortable ideas of speech considered not politically correct, students are censoring and calling for the removal of teachers or the source of the ideas rather than hearing them. Social media definitely conspires in this. It often discourages dissent within a cluster of friends by accelerating shaming. Facebook allows people to react to each other so quickly that they're afraid to step out of line. But that's not about a lot, and that's not about a lopsided news feed or algorithm. It's about tribalism, and that's existed for as long as we've been here and is now growing in the fertile soil of the internet. So let's consider what Bill Bishop and Robert Cushing put in their 2008 book, The Big Sort, summarizing the results of research on group polarization. I'll repeat it twice. Mixed company moderates, like-minded company polarizes. Heterogeneous communities restrain group excesses, and homogeneous communities march toward the extreme. Mixed company moderates, like-minded company polarizes. Heterogeneous communities restrain group excesses, and homogeneous communities march toward the extreme. Compared to 1960, Americans today are far less likely to describe those in the other political party as intelligent, and far more likely to say that they would be displeased or unhappy if they had a child who married a member of the other party. A Pew survey in 2014 found that 27% of Democrats and 36% of Republicans currently view the other party as a threat to the nation's well-being. David Blankenhorn, in a December article called Why Polarization Matters, says, historically, polarization tended to be rooted in only a few and related issues, disputes over foreign alliances and the size of the government around 1800, the National Bank in the 1830s, the split over slavery in the 1850s, the agrarian revolt and related currency disputes in the 1890s, and the struggles over the New Deal in the 1930s, and finally Vietnam and civil rights in the 1860s. Today's polarization, in a trend that some scholars call conflict extension, appears to be much broader, such that it seems to draw almost all issues, from educational standards to guns, to climate research, to foreign policy, to church and state issues, into its maw. In short, political polarization in the United States today has become, by political standards, less issue-specific and more generalized. It seems that in all human groups, there seems to be a powerful urge to dichotomize, to classify other human beings into two artificially sharpened categories. This urge should be consciously criticized and resisted. He then outlined some of the ways polarization affects us. I'm just going to read those quickly. It says, number one, it produces policy gridlock and the inability or willingness to compromise. Number two, it degrades our public discussion. Number three, it segregates us into tribes. And number four, it undermines trust in our government and each other. Number five, it thwarts empathy toward the other, those outside our group. We can all see that there is a problem, but how do we go about solving it? I like to think that as you use, we already have a desire for diversity or thought in our group, and that we would already be ahead of the game on solving this. My first thoughts about solving this, and I've been thinking about this since reading the stuff on my news feed for a couple of years now. My first thoughts about how to solve this were divided, mirrored, were from one of the principles that I read in a book called The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. The principle is seek first to understand, then to be understood, which calls for us to listen with empathy first before trying to convince others of our own viewpoints. But to my delight, I stumbled across someone else who had the same idea and went on to give some strategies to depolarize people. David Blankenhorn, in his piece on the seven habits of highly depolarizing people, draws inspiration from that habit that I mentioned. And it also draws a second source of inspiration from the seven virtues of classical Christianity. Hopefully, with these ideas in mind, we can try to transition to less polarizing ways of analyzing issues and expressing ourselves. With enough work, maybe even we can turn them into our intellectually default settings, a pair of fishing glasses for a different way of seeing what's needed. As Abraham Lincoln put it in 1862, when the occasion is piled high with difficulty, the first and great challenge is to think anew. So how do we make friends and influence people on the other side of the aisle? How do we have a conversation where both sides walk away better for it? How do we get our own pair of fishing glasses? The number one is criticize from within. In other words, criticize the other, whether person, group, or society, on the basis of something that you have in common. The idea of recognizing something that is shared with the other even in moments of fierce conflict, is beautifully reflected in Lincoln's use of the term the better angels in his first inaugural address. On the eve of the Civil War, William Seward, who would serve as Secretary of State under Lincoln, had suggested that the new president conclude by calling his hope upon the guardian angel of the nation. Lincoln changed it to the better angels of our nature. In Seward's version, what was needed would come from outside of us. In Lincoln's version, what would needed would come from within us, something better in the nature of both Northerners and Southerners. Number two, look for goods in conflict. Some conflicts are entirely about good versus evil or right versus wrong. But many, and probably most, are more about good versus good or right versus right. Each side, at least in part, is likely to be defending a goal or value that they both recognize as worthy. The challenge in such cases is to recognize and weigh competing goods, a challenge that is different from, and maybe harder than, distinguishing good from bad. Always for the possible existence of goods in conflict, not only contributes to depolarization, but it also contributes to achieving valid, as opposed to phony, disagreement. Number three, count higher than two. Of all the mental habits that encourage polarization, the most dangerous is probably binary thinking. The tendency to divide everything into two mutually antagonistic categories. One may be the loneliest number, but in the area of social criticism and conflict, two, which is far from lonely today, is probably the most harmful. In thinking through a challenge or conflict, the highly depolarizing person's first question should be to him or herself, can I count higher than two? Number four, doubt. Doubt, the concern that my views may not be entirely correct, is the true friend of wisdom, and along with empathy, for which it's related, the greatest enemy of polarization. The playwright and political leader Vaclav Havel famously said that he would rather have a beer with someone who's searching for the truth than with someone who's found it. He was advocating against the type of certitude that breeds smugness and contempt for one's opponents. In today's polarized environment, doubt is often treated as a weakness or even a sin. But the opposite is more likely to be true. Doubt often supports true convictions based on realistic foundations, just as doubtlessness is nearly always an intellectual disability or a form of blindness. Because number five and six, specify and qualify. Because generalization is both an ally and a frequent indicator of polarization, depolarized people should be connoisseurs of the specific. Stereotyping and throwing ideas into broad categories hurts our thinking as well as discussion. And number seven, keep the conversation going. At the very heart of democratic civil society is the idea that we don't stop talking to one another, even when, and perhaps especially when, the conversation is frustrating and seems futile. Because ending the conversation is tantamount to ending the relationship. And when the relationship ends, everything hardens. Polarization reigns, and your opponent turns into enemies. I'll conclude with something that the great sage John Stewart said on David Axelrod's podcast last month. A student asked the question, how do you keep your sanity amid the onslaught of 24-hour news networks? And John's answer was, you don't. People get lost in it. And I think you begin to think that it's real life, and you have to understand that when you watch it, it is designed for a reason, and the reason is to heighten urgency and anxiety so that you won't turn away. You can begin to think that that's real, but it's not. So just keep that in mind. And then he paused dramatically and said, and then I'll add my own addition and say, fishing glasses. Thank you.